Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing another of the interviews I did at the 2013 Miami Book Fair. Today's interview is with Ridley Pearson, who is there promoting his 47th book. In addition to the mysteries that Ridley is turning out at an amazing rate, he's written virtually every other form that you can think of. He's also a musician who has written many, many musical compositions and plays with the Rock Bottom Remainders, a rock and roll group made up of authors who have come together to have fun and to raise money for nonprofits. So if you enjoy this interview only half as much as I did, it will be worth listening to. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Is all about being who you really are. As a therapist, I see day in and day out examples of people who are not living the life that was really meant for them to live, who are not all that they really are, but who are living instead what I call a cover story. That is a version of who they are, which is the truth. It's just not the whole truth. It is the truth which their childhood required them to think of as the whole truth. This can happen in all kinds of ways. Quite often, something that is natural to us doesn't go down that well with our family of origin. And so they let us know in one way or another, sometimes very subtly, you know, with a rolling of the eyes or a sigh or even a sort of neglect at the moment when we are doing these things. And of course that can escalate to don't do that, or who do you think you are, or go to your room, or you're crying, I'm gonna give you something to cry about, or you're just like your dreadful Uncle Harry, or you know, all those kinds of direct statements which tell you that that behavior, that that talent, that way of being is not acceptable. And unfortunately, that can escalate up to punishment and trauma. But no matter how, we get the idea that this quality does not go down well in our particular family of origin. We quickly learn how first to pretend we don't have it and then to forget we had it all together. So we come into adulthood without access to that thing, whatever it was. Our easy access to our tears when we're sad or hurt or scared, or our easy access to our laughter when we're excited or happy, or easy access to our attraction to words or music or dance. Lots of talents are squashed very, very young, very, very soon, in a situation where they are not understood or accepted. And this can happen not only in our family of origin, but in our schools. Teachers have been known to squash instincts, talents, abilities, just as often as they have been known to develop, encourage, and even point out. If you've been listening to my show, there are a number of examples where teachers have said to a student, "Oh, boy, you do that great." Or, "Have you thought about that as a career? You're a natural at that." Even one interview of mine where the child was so shy that, you know, speaking in public was just an impossibility. And yet a teacher gently encouraged this boy to just tell a poem, you know, read a poem in class. And that led to a career as an actor. He discovered in that moment, but it was the encouragement, right? So I don't want to suggest that teachers are always squashing. Often they are making the difference, but they do sometimes squash. And not only our family of origin and our schools and our teachers, but religion has been known to squash lots of natural instincts. Cultures, our culture, the culture you grow up in, which thinks that dancing is the devil's tool, or as one client of mine experienced, she could sing, but only if she sang religious songs, and so a whole bunch of stuff that's just so magical for her has been so difficult for her to do. So if this happens to you in your childhood, that is that you get the idea that something about you is not okay, and you learn, as children are so flexible and able to do, to hide that, whatever it was, and then to forget that you have it, then you come into adulthood with what I called earlier, you're a cover story, this version of yourself. And you not only present this as the whole truth, and you are not only then unable to access all of who you are, and you don't get to experience and benefit from all of who you are, but you establish relationships with people based on this cover story. I call this the relationship contract. That is that whenever two people begin a relationship, you know, parent-child, sibling, friend, employer-employee, neighbor, it doesn't matter what the relationship is. That when a relationship is begun, it seems to me that we sign on to a contract, a relationship contract. It's not written down, and it only has one clause. I'll be who I am, and you be who you are. And as long as I continue to be the person I was when we signed on to this contract, and you continue to be the person that you were when we signed on to this contract, then the relationship, even if we don't like it or we're mad about it or we wish it would change, it feels somehow right. And people continue to live up to these contracts for sometimes their entire lives. The problem with this is that if you realize that there is some way in which you have been that you no longer want to be, Maybe there's a quality that you want to access that you didn't. Maybe you figure out that you were denied some aspect of yourself and you are able to change that. Well, then, the people that you are in relationship with who count on you being this way feel that they have been betrayed, that you have broken the contract. In fact, you have broken the contract. And if they can't change complementarily, then those relationships are in jeopardy. I believe that we all know unconsciously that this is so, and that this is the single biggest reason why people don't change when they really want to. Because even though the change they wish to make might make their life better, in fact, in some cases, might even save their life, if it means jeopardizing those relationships which have been the most important, that's a terrific stumbling block to making these changes. I saw an Oprah segment which made this point so dramatically, I was stunned. It was at the time when Oprah had lost a great deal of weight, and apparently she got a bunch of hate mail from people with whom she had relationship contracts, audience members with whom she had a relationship contract. The relationship contract being, I will be overweight, and so, and in that way I will be like you. And when she was no longer overweight, therefore no longer like them, people felt betrayed by her. She had on in that segment three different couples who had experienced this as well. I believe there was a mother and daughter, and there were cousins and a couple of best friends. They had both been overweight, and one of them had lost weight. And the relationships were challenged by this. When the relationship contract is about weight, which is only one of the many millions of things it can be about, people who share this, you know, quite often share diets, workout strategies, being contemptuous of thin people, being jealous of thin people. There are a whole range of behaviors, attitudes, ways of being, consolation that they share. And when one of them loses weight, the other feels that the relationship has been the contract has been broken, which, as I said, of course it has. So the Lynn Show is about considering the possibility that there is something about you for which you have been in denial. Something about you which, if you had it back, would make your life fuller, more whole, more satisfactory. And at the same time, it might put relationships in jeopardy. So, I'm hoping that as you are listening to this, you are thinking about this, asking yourself if perhaps you have left some significant part of yourself behind and would like to think about recovering it. And if this is so, of course, psychotherapy is one of the best ways to do that. If you'd like to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. thelynnesshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. That's thelynnshow.com. And up on that website, you can listen to all of my previous shows in which I talk about this. You can get access to my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can read the article I wrote about psychotherapy on the go, which is about psychotherapy on the telephone, which is how I do it these days. And you can hear all of the interviews that I have done, including the one I'm going to air today. I play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to a person who has dedicated their life in some way to an art, you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, to be what we therapists call congruent. And of course, it is my hope that when you listen to that, you ask yourself, am I congruent? Am I living the life that best fits me? And today's interview is with Ridley Pearson, who is an author. And Ridley demonstrates extraordinarily well the ability to be who you are. I'm not going to say very much more about this because Ridley says it so well, but you can hear when you listen to him talking about writing and talking about music, his twin loves, the commitment, the attachment, the giving into this thing which not only fills up his life, but satisfies him in such an important way. In addition to being an extraordinarily prolific producer of words and music, Ridley is a part of a rock and roll group of authors. He will talk about it in the interview, called the Rock Bottom Remainders. And after the interview, I'm going to play you part of the audio part of a video of the Rock Bottom Remainders. But right now, here is Ridley Pearson. Okay, I'm here with Ridley Pearson. And
hi, Lynn.
Hi, Ridley. And good God, what is this, your 50th book or something?
It's 47th.
Really? Yeah. Oh my God, I was really close.
You were?
Amazing. I'm
crazy, stunned
by this stuff.
Yeah.
By the quantity, never mind everything else.
Well, I know it's you hope there's quality in there.
Well,
it's funny because you do a career like this and I don't write them fast by any means. I write six drafts
of
every
young.
Book and I did. Well, I started
in my
30s.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So not that young.
Okay. So I always ask a question. I interview people.
That's a good idea when you interview somebody.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well,
I think it helps.
We'll see.
Yeah, you can make statements, but then the person on the other end goes, "Oh,
yeah."
Yeah.
Right.
Perfect. Well said. So ask a question.
I'm not going to stop you. You're on a roll. Are you kidding? I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
That's
I'm sorry you can't see the look on his face. I really am.
That was a statement, man.
I know it. And the look, you didn't even bother to talk.
It's a statement.
It's a statement, I know. And I ask this question of people who make their living or their life with an art.
So you're saying I'm so average that you're just going to ask the average question you always ask?
Yes.
Okay. I accept that.
In my experience,
yes.
People who make their living or their life with an art,
yes,
are exceptional.
Well,
because it's so difficult to
do. I thought you said you've done this a long time.
I have done it a long time.
Don't you know we're actually sort of average hideaways who just don't want contact with human beings?
I think you're speaking for yourself here. Not everyone who makes their living with an art is a hideaway.
I've met and spent my life with a lot of artists and creative people, and there's just nothing better.
I agree, which is why I do this.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I ask is, given that you already said that you didn't actually start writing until you were 30.
I said I wasn't published.
You weren't published. Yeah, okay, all right.
I started writing at 10.
Yeah, and that the question I ask is not so much when you started writing, although I'm curious about that, but when did you know? When was the moment that you knew that writing, that stories, that words mattered to you, called you, impacted you?
I mean, we all come out of different environments. My environment was a set of really loving parents. We had a somewhat dysfunctional family, but it was a set of really loving parents and really loving grandparents. And both my maternal grandfather and my paternal grandfather. Now that I look back with a question like that, I don't get a question like that very often, but I know when it was because my roly-poly maternal grandfather was an incredibly, he was a tinkerer And, you know, he had one of those immaculate wood shops in his basement. He could fix anything, think of something creative to scare the magpies away. He was a Kansan. And he was quite the amazing guy. And he would, I remember being enchanted by Story from the time I could sit on his lap. And he would tell tales. And it was kind of oral history. He would tell us about his youth, you know, or read a book or something. My dad was a writer in the corporate world.
Wait a minute.
And no, I'm going to go back.
No, I understand.
I will tie it all together seamlessly.
I know that.
That you just simply can't believe. Go ahead.
It's not just writer. Clearly, it is not just writer. But sit on his lap. 4, 6, 2
minutes?
Age.
Oh, yeah, no, really little. 5, 6
Yeah.
But this is his scene. He had, and so he would tell stories about this. He was, you know, he grew up in the mid and late, I think he was born in 1880 or 1882. And as a young man in Kansas, he decided that education was everything. And he headed out as a telegraph operator, following the telegraph line from Kansas west, and earned his living as a telegraph operator and installer of some of the gear, and saved his money, lived very sparsely, saved his money and sent it home so he could put his brother through KU, Kansas University.
Really?
Not for him,
the education, but for his brother.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure his brother got an education.
This is his younger brother.
Mm-hmm. So he goes off and does all this for, I think, 6 years or something, and sends all the money back to his brother, who, in fact, you know, listens to older brother and goes to college. And when older brother gets home, younger brother had saved all the money and put himself through college and gave him the money and said, now you go to college.
God, I have tears in my eyes.
Yeah, so those were, and what he did in those era, in that era, was he lived in Indian camps. So we have in our family somewhere, we have these old moccasins from the 1890s, early 1900s, the peace pipes, this stuff probably should all be in a museum now. But he would tell us stories, who knows how embellished they were, and I don't remember any of them, but I remember just being enthralled with this guy.
And
so I think probably because I'm really, I don't know how much of a writer I am. I'm always trying to be a writer. I work every day at trying to be a writer. But I am a storyteller, and sort of first and foremost, so I've written a million zillion songs and told stories in those, and I've written screenplays and told stories in those, and I have these 47 books that are published, and I've told stories in those. But as writers, you work to be a better writer every day of your life. You know, it's a very challenging, challenging thing to do, and there are people who I think very legitimately can sit down and say, I am a writer. I write stories. I don't know that I've earned yet somebody saying this is a writer.
Okay, stop. I want to challenge that and talk about it, but first, I want to ask. So, this picture of this compelling and incredibly loving and committed man telling you these stories. Do you remember, did you start to make up stories? Did you say...
Not long after that, but not that day. I forgot to tell the other side of the story, which is my paternal grandfather. My dad he's passed on now, but just an insanely bright human being. And his dad, who was kind of he wasn't a ne'er-do-well, but he just never really held a job or worked much. Kind of a funny guy in a lot of ways.
Kind of the opposite of your
brilliant
paternal
guy.
Grandfather.
And what he would do is sit us down on his lap, and he could recite things like Charge of the Light Brigade in its entirety from memory.
Wow.
And he had a zillion of the long-form poems in his head. And whenever you sat down with Pid, I was named after him, his name was Ridley, he would go into this, you know, this just, you know, sonorous, endless, adventures that he would take you on by the, and he had them all memorized, which, you know, I can't remember where I was earlier today. So the fact that he was doing this late in life, my age or certainly older than I am now, and just meticulously memorized with inflections and, you know, drama in it. And this guy was unbelievable. So on the one side, I had the, yeah, and he was skinny as a rail. So on the one side, I had the, you know, kind of roly-poly grandfather who probably made up half the stuff. And on the other side, the skinny, you know, drink of water grandfather who had this phenomenal library of unbelievable epic poems.
Yeah, but it's not only that.
Memorized.
He was a performer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He was, actually. He called one of his many crazy jobs is when I knew him in my life, he was a square dance caller. That's what he did. He dressed up and he got up there with a microphone here in Florida. Yeah, go to your left hand, you know, do
it. He was an entertainer, this guy. Mm-hmm. A very smart entertainer. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
living
you
on not much.
What? Living on not much. Well,
yeah.
Apparently that was all right with him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so this is the, I don't know, the etiology, this is the stuff.
Yeah.
So when did you start writing? And did you say...
Well, writing started out a competitive sport for me, which it isn't. But it got that way because my brother, I'm the youngest, if you can believe that, in a family. And my brother and sister had taken courses in downtown Old Greenwich to touch type. And there were these little books that came with it. And my dad, of course, could type. And then my brother could type and my sister could type. And I was not going to be the lone duck. So I took my sister's book and took one of the manual typewriters that was lying around the house and taught myself to touch type at 10. And then I realized, and I was a fast, accurate typist, but I had nothing to type. And I didn't want to just, like, what I was doing to teach myself to type was I was typing pages from books that I like, Jack London and that kind of stuff, which actually, now that I think back, that probably influenced me.
Yeah,
that
sure was
probably some kind of thing going on there. But I soon realized the only way I was going to...
Wait. So you were reading?
I was reading and touch typing.
No, I mean...
I was a reader.
Were a reader from...
But I was a television kid, too. I was addicted to television, back when there were 3 channels.
And there were stories on television.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
Rin Tin Tin.
But you were already interested in stories.
I was, and once you brought that up, I've never really connected these dots, but I'm sure it's my two grandfathers, you know. The epic poems were amazing.
Yeah.
Because they are just these endless stories. They go on for hours. He could go for an hour and a half on one of these things, you know. And you were just wherever it was. You were in Arabia. You were in New England with Ichabod Crane. Wherever you were, you were gone.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, so
great.
I think you understood viscerally the power of stories.
I suppose I didn't know I understood that.
Well, it was not necessarily conscious.
I'm still working on that.
So you're touch typing and
right, and making up stories.
So that's what happened.
Yeah. I bet I wrote 100 short stories between the time I was 10 and the time I was maybe 14 or 15. Then, you know, high school comes along, college comes along. You don't do much of it. And I got out of college. I tried to be...
Wait. Major in college?
Major in college was dropout. I majored in dropping out. I started out in pre-med because I really liked math and science. And I went to a boarding school, and one of my roommates at boarding school had a cancer called Hodgkin's disease.
Mm.
And he called me up, and he said, I know this is an imposition, but I'm going to go through treatment. And I wondered if you would leave college and live with me and my parents while I go through treatment. And I said, I'm there. So I packed up and left, and I never really got back to college. I went to Brown shortly after that for a while, but sadly I never got out with a degree. It's one of the great, great losses of my life.
Why?
I hate not having that degree.
Why?
I don't know. I'm a finisher.
Ask him.
Yeah, but I'm a finisher.
Oh, because you think that there's something...
I'm just a finisher. I'm an Eagle Scout, which took, you know, until I was 16 to get that. And I didn't have any interest, but I wanted to finish. You know, when you write a book, you can bail or you can finish it. You know, when you perform a piece of music, you can mess it all up, but you still have to finish it. I'm a finisher, and I didn't finish college, and it has worn on me like an
I see it.
Yoke for my whole life.
So are you planning to go back?
No, I tried to go back actually about a year ago, and I'm just too busy, you know. I'm writing 2 books a year, screenplays.
But you could go back in a writing program and then use all that stuff.
Well, but you got to get through, believe me, I've looked into all of this. But the only real reason I want the degree is I want to be able to teach anywhere I want to teach.
I got it.
And I love to teach.
You know, there are these schools where you get credit for, you know, life experience, mm-hmm. and you can design your own thing.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, and you can do it at home. I mean, you know, you don't have to.
That's what I tried to do. And there's just no time.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
You've done all that. You know all that.
It's
sorry.
Fine.
And it's none of my business anyway.
No, it's fine.
Okay, fine.
It's not fine!
I know. Yeah. I know. Regret is a terrible
thing. It is a terrible thing.
Yeah, regret is a terrible thing.
It's one of the only things that I'm just saddled with.
Yeah, I'm so sorry because I
really I've earned millions of dollars and I've sold billions of books and everything's great.
Yeah,
but
I
regret that.
I think regret is a terrible waste of time. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
It's a cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah, this thing's plagued me my whole life. I tell people, I go, why do you even care? You're this, you're that, you're this, you're that, you know? And I say, I care.
I know, I understand that you do, and I'm sorry, because I think of it as what you
I know,
say
that's
it
why
is.
I tried to, just to get rid of the regret is why I went back. I tried to go back about 2 years ago, and I said, this will just get it out of my way.
Yes.
And I couldn't, you know, again, I was just too busy. So. It's a good thing. I like being busy.
Okay. So... You got out of college, you were done, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and you said, oh, what am I going to do now? Oh, I'm going to
No, not really. I you know, I went and lived with my friend who had Hodgkin's.
Right.
And we went through treatment. He was throwing up every night and losing his hair and doing all those things you do. And that went on for maybe 6 months. And we had been music buddies at school that we went, where
you
we boarded.
You wrote?
Yeah,
I mean, you
we
played
wrote and played, kind of Simon and Garfunkel kind of things.
What do you play?
Well, then I played acoustic guitar. I now play, in the Rock Bottom Remainders, I play bass. Rock Bottom Remainders is a band of authors with Stephen King, Amy Tan, Dave Berry, Greg Iles, Roger McGuinn from The Byrds.
I know.
And we're playing tonight
here
at the Miami Book Fair.
I don't suppose you have a CD you can give me. I really
no,
like to play it.
No, because we're awful. I don't want to be with us. We have a lot of fun. And we've raised $2.5 million for nonprofit.
Okay, so we still have you at what looks to be 25, 22 something, right? I mean...
Well, I went off to be James Taylor. What happened was my friend and I did coffee shops and wrote our original songs and played all over New England for 11 years.
Wow.
I mean,
so you weren't writing then?
Well, what happened was just years into that, maybe 3 years into that, I realized I didn't want to be doing this when I was 50.
Yeah.
Because we were having, you know, we kept going for the big break, and the big break didn't happen.
Right.
And I think I was sort of wise enough to realize, no college degree.
Right.
You know, what the heck am I going to do? I do not want to be moving a ton of equipment when I'm 45.
Kidding. Right.
And so I started writing. I went back to my life. And not knowing that that was harder than music.
I was just going to say, so I thought I'd be a writer.
I know. Mm. Yeah. Really brilliant.
Yeah, all right.
So it took 8.5 years. I wrote 6 hours a day and played music at night for 8.5 years before anybody bought my fiction. I was writing nonfiction, then magazine stuff to keep myself alive. But
okay, so the first book that got published was?
Never Look Back. How do you like that?
Yeah.
Pretty funny.
What year was that?
That was 85.
You know, I went online to my library and looked at, the first book that I found was written in 1992.
Yeah, so I had written 7 or 8 books by then.
Oh, my God. So I listened to In Harm's Way.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
I did.
Did you like it?
I liked it, but I didn't like her.
Uh-huh. No, yeah, Fiona?
Yeah, I didn't like her, and
she's a tough character.
And I wondered why you did that.
You'll like Grace Chu. If you ever can read either Risk Agent or Choke Point, Grace Chu is a completely different character than Fiona. But
I wondered if you didn't want us to like her.
No, I just wanted her to be her, you know? And if you like her, you like her, and if you don't like her, you don't like her. I get that. But I really knew her. I knew she had come from, I knew that, you know, fiction is really about secrets.
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 Oh, secrets.
We all have them. And if it's a mystery, you're unfolding that secret. If it's a family you know, big family saga, you're unfolding those secrets. But if you think of like Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca or something, you know, it's what we love to read about is what the other person isn't willing to tell us.
Well, that part of it,
Fiona is a secret. She's an enigmatic character because she isn't even who she says she is.
No.
And I knew that about her. She shows up in the first book.
That's my question.
Yeah.
What was the book that before? Because
there's a bunch of books. There's Killer Summer, Killer Weekend, Killer View,
In Harm's Way. I hadn't read them, and I knew, and I couldn't find them.
Uh-huh.
So I knew that there was, it's different if I've read the other ones.
It might be, but, you know, they all have to stand alone, and you write them so they stand alone. But yes, there's a...
No, it's quite clear.
You know, there's a bit of a history between she and some of the characters.
Right,
yeah, Walt
right.
people.
And then there's all that stuff with Walt and his wife and
and of course
Tommy.
That's much clearer.
And that's I assumed because there was books I hadn't read, but it wasn't that. It was that she says, I mean, at some point she says, you know, this is 2 years in the making, and you know, her relationship with Walt, right? And it's 2 years in the making, and she gives herself to him physically with no holds barred, but she won't trust him in any other way. Mm-hmm. And I found that an odd paradox.
Yeah, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just glad to have an opportunity.
No, I hear you. But I think that's, you know, that was true to her.
Apparently.
Because she's scared.
Yeah, no, I know that.
This is a woman who's been scared for years now.
Right.
And she's basically hiding.
Yeah.
And everything she's doing is...
To protect that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand
and
that.
She finally can give himself to this man, which has taken her 4 books.
Yeah,
and many years in their relationship.
Right.
But because she adores him, and they understand each other, but she's still not willing to pull the veil down. And I think...
Well, never mind the veil down. She's not willing to trust him.
Right.
That's different. When he says, you know, don't go out of the house, you know, she isn't willing to trust that. Mm-hmm. That's different from pull the veil down.
In that case, I think it's because, you know, independence breeds a certain autonomy that you're not going to listen to any authority.
Do you know about that?
No comments.
That was a question. It wasn't a statement. It was not a statement. I didn't say
something about that.
Tell me.
Yeah. No.
You should. I'm really sorry this isn't video. Because he's blushing.
I'm blushing.
I know. It's adorable. So you don't want to say anything about that? About your relationship to authority? Or?
No.
No? Okay. All right. So, I can't get over this. So you think, well, you know, playing and singing and entertaining is too goddamn hard. I'm going to be a writer. Oy.
Yeah, little did I know.
Well, you did. Apparently you didn't know.
Because I write for kids also, I talk at schools, and I talk about how, you know if you're a writer. Sure, it can be taught a little bit. And critical, I really take issue with the fact that most of our education is about critical writing. I mean, you know, why do we turn our kids critical from an early age? But that's what we do. But you know if you're a writer. You know if you're a storyteller. And there was, you know, Dave Barry, my co-writer on some books years ago, has a great line of, you know, I have no useful skills, so I'm a writer. And there's a bit of that. I think I felt a little paralyzed by my lack of a degree and was worried no one would hire me to do anything. And that I was going to have to stand on my own. And what could I do? And my dad had been a writer, and I thought, maybe I can write. And I love writing. So, I mean, even now if I was working for IBM, I'd be writing at night. That's why we see, you know, doctors who become bestsellers and attorneys who become bestsellers. It's because when you're a writer, you have to write.
Right.
You're just going to do it whether you're a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, and some of them get lucky and do it very well. And I guarantee you there are 20,000 manuscripts in somebody's drawer somewhere all over the world of very successful people who write because they love to write and they've never even shown it to anyone.
No, and also people who play instruments, even though that's not what they do for a living, and people who paint, although that's not what they do for a living.
Absolutely. Art is our release. It's our self-expression.
Right. Yeah. So I'm interested to hear you talk like this.
I feel like this is a therapy session or something.
I can't imagine why.
Was this arranged? I don't think that tape recorder is even on.
Who would have arranged it?
My wife. Who else?
Yes.
Hi, honey.
The thing is that you can say in the same half hour, you know when you're a writer, and I'm a writer, and I still can't call myself a writer.
Yeah.
It's a real paradox.
I'm a published author.
I understand.
I can call myself that.
No, well,
you know what I mean?
I'm going to play this back for you. Where
no, I did say that because, and that's what I'm trying to say. I'm proud of the fact that I'm a published author. Mm-hmm. But there is, I think, a conceit in the world of published authors that there are writers and there are genre writers, if you will. And I'm certainly a genre writer. I'm a commercial writer. I'm writing to entertain you. I'm writing to consume you.
Yeah.
You know, I want you to look over at the clock and go, it's 2 a.m. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I have to be up for work. Yeah. You know, whereas other people are writing to light a fire under you intellectually or change the world or reflect on America. You know, that's just not what I do. So I maybe what I should say is I'm not a literary writer. I try to write in a very literary way. I work really hard on that to make it very readable and poetic and
literate.
Fun to read, you know, because I love sound. I'm a musician. I want it to sound right, and I read these things aloud, and I read them now to my computer and play them back in a voice like this that goes along, and I go, well, that doesn't sound very good. But I want it to sound right, you know. So I might cut something out of a sentence that's really important, but it just didn't have a rhythm, that it didn't have a cadence that sentence needed to have, if that makes any sense.
And of course it makes sense to me, but we just have a difference of opinion.
Yeah.
I don't differentiate. For me, a person who writes, who is as entranced by writing, who fell in love with writing, who is compelled to write, is a writer.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, on those passport things, when you're coming in and out of the country, you have to put what you do. And every now and then I will put writer. Most of the time I put author.
Yeah. I got it.
And that's, you know.
I understand.
I think one of the things is that it's maybe what probably a more legitimate way for me to say it is that I'm a workman. You know, I'm a, what is it when there's an apprentice in a profession?
There's an apprentice.
Journeyman.
A journeyman.
I'm a journeyman writer. In that on the day I could really call myself a writer, I'd probably want to stop and go do something else.
Oh, nonsense.
No, I think it probably is true.
Because I
try to do it better every time.
Wait. Is that because you think there's a place that one can get that has the, you know,
the gravitas of it?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe.
And then,
I think it's an internal place.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's a success thing or this thing.
No.
My favorite book is To Kill a Mockingbird, and I think, you know, if someday I wrote To Kill a Mockingbird and I put that last period and I knew that was my To Kill a Mockingbird, I'd probably walk away because there's so many things I want to do.
What else do you want to do?
Oh, you kidding me? Name it. I want to write movies. I want to direct movies. I want to write television. I'd love to write for theater. I've written symphonic scores for documentary films and things. I would really love to have 3 or 4 years in a little cottage somewhere and be able to crank out a symphony or two. I have a symphonic poem that a friend of mine finally synthesized music-wise so I could hear it. I'd never heard it. I'd written it 30 years ago. So, I mean, there's a million things I've
done. Forgive me, but you can't possibly need to be writing these books for the money.
Oh, sure. I've got two kids going into college. Absolutely.
I see. So that's what's keeping you from writing symphonies and plays?
No, what's keeping me from writing symphonies and plays is I love what I'm doing, which is writing books.
Yeah.
And I'm really blessed in that I have many projects that people want me and are hiring me to do. So I'm writing, 6 to 11 hours a day. And there's not a lot of time. I want to spend time with my kid. My first job in life is a father, and my second is a husband, and my third is a writer.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense.
So, the free time I have, I want to goof around with my kids or watch a movie with my kids or...
Right, I got it.
Or hang with my wife.
I got it.
Yeah.
Do they write?
My daughter just got a 790 on her SAT in writing.
Wow.
It shocked her. It shocked us all. Because she doesn't write much. She got a really high score on her reading, not very well, didn't do very well on her math. But it really, it stunned all of us. That's 10 points off of perfect, And she just doesn't write that much. And I just went, sweetheart, I didn't get a 790. I think they could write. I don't think they ever would because they see that, it basically is killing daddy every day. So, I'm in my office from 7 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon.
But I'm under
unbelievable pressure on these books, and they see that, and I think wonder why I keep doing it. But I love it.
I was just going to say, don't they see the?
Yeah, I think they. I mean, yeah, sure. The thing is, the joy of writing is in the moment you're writing.
Yes.
So they don't see that because they aren't in the room with me.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And you can't see that.
No.
That's something you can't.
You just
come in and see me tired.
Yeah.
But they don't know that inside I'm going, wow!
Yeah, I know.
So, no, they don't, show don't tell, and I can't show them. I can tell them, I had a great day, I was in Disney World fighting the villains, and they go, okay.
Yeah, but it's really what you said before, which is a writer knows that they are.
Yeah. And they see that, and they see the blessings that have come to our family because I'm a writer. The people that we know, and Roger McGuinn spending the night at our house and playing music with me in the living room. And as they've gotten older, they've looked back on some of that stuff and said, "Is that the guy from the Birds?" I go, "Yeah, that's Uncle Roger." And they're like, "Whoa!" So they we get these free cruises by Disney because I write for Disney and they want me to write.
But that's not the same thing.
No, but they see that's, of course, to a kid.
Yeah.
That's what they think writing is all the stuff you get for.
Yeah, but it's the same thing with kids who start to play a guitar and think they're going to be the Beatles.
Exactly.
But that's not what makes a writer or a musician.
No, and that's why you said, do they know what
I do know. They
can't know that until they. Sometimes they'll sit down to write a story for school, and it'll take them 5 days to write a page and a half.
Yeah.
And they'll go, whoa, to me. And I go, yeah, because they know I write 2,000 words a day,
God.
And they're like, whoa.
Well, okay, so I have another question, and it is, having given, and you give your life to this work, to the work of being a writer, what would you say about that? What that's like?
Well, it's something, at least for me, I never take it for granted because I've been without, I spent 8.5 years trying to get this, and I'm just not going to let it go. It's this incredible gift that your readers give you by going out and buying the books, which is sadly a hugely important part of this because we aren't 300 years ago where everybody had somebody to support them, the church or this or that. But they give you this gift, the readers do, by buying the books, saying, I like the stories you tell. And I take that responsibility really seriously. I'm not the writer who goes out and golfs every afternoon, and I probably should, but I don't, that's not what I do.
No, you're a finisher.
I'm a finisher, and I want to take on as many projects as I can. I want to get as much out there as I can in this short time we all have. But I so appreciate doing this for a living that I go in and I work at it, and I try to do better every book, and I try to do better every page of every book, And you don't always. And then you're crushed. You know, there's just nothing harder about this job than devoting yourself to it. Every book is a year, year and a half. And grueling hours, many drafts. I write 5-6 drafts. I write 3,000 pages to publish a 400-page book. You know, every darn time. And you do all that, and then some guy in Denver, you know, reads your book in an afternoon and doesn't like it, and writes a thing to his 500,000 people that read his paper that this is a piece of junk. And you just can't imagine. It's not that he isn't entitled to the opinion. It probably is a piece of junk. But if you get those kind of reviews, you just, so you try not to read them, but you do. You see them every now and then. I bet 90% of my reviews I never read. But you see a few that you don't, you wish you hadn't. I'm really blessed in that 90% of my reviews are glowing. But, you know, it's really tough when you get these reviews and you think, so in your 3 hours in the afternoon, you're allowed to crush my 18 months.
Right.
You know, and my love of these characters and my love of that story and all the research I did. And when people buy the books, it shows they like them. And thankfully, my readership has gone up steadily for 30 years and is at an all-time peak. So I know people like the books. And I take that really seriously. And I you know, I want to write a better book next time. And I want to keep writing books until I drop.
And I think that's a very good place to stop. Thank you
Thank you so much,
Ridley.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This was great.
And I want to keep writing books till I drop. Could anyone have described their being who they really are better than that? Ridley Pearson is a writer. He loves what he does, and he does it with his whole heart. And it is, as I said, my hope that as you were listening to Ridley, as you were listening to the way he, 8 years, he wrote for 8 years before he got published, he just kept doing it. And he says in there, if you're a writer, you know it, because you have to write. Have you been hidden from something that you really are? Would you like to feel about yourself the way Ridley feels about himself? It's not impossible, although if you were listening to the beginning of the show, you heard me talking about some of the things that get between us and being who we really are. But I want to say it again, it's not impossible, and it is not too late. And it's not just about an art or a skill. It can be about your way of being in the world. So again, if you want to get in touch with me, you can do that by going up on my website, thelinshow.com. And as I promised, we're going to go out on the audio portion of a video of the Rock Bottom Remainders. You can hear the authors talking about how they felt about getting into this rock and roll group. The first person that you hear is Ridley. See if you can figure out who the other famous authors are. Okay. As always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that you didn't know, something that tickled your fancy, something that intrigued you or inspired you, something that will bring you back. Because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
When you're a writer, you're just in the communication business. I mean, all of it's communications arts. And being up there on stage, you get to do all the things you don't get to do when you're stuck in front of a word processor for 10 hours a day. It's sort of like being released from jail, maybe like day work from jail.
Yeah! Oh, yeah.
Have you heard the news? There's good rock in the night. I'm gonna hold my baby just as tight as I can. Tonight she'll know that I'm a mighty man. If you heard the news, there's good rock in the night. I said I got the news, everybody rocking the night. Have you heard the news, everybody rocking the night.
The magic of the Remainders is they get to be a rock band, a royally treated rock band without having to play like one.
Rock Bottom Remainders, who are they?
We like to define this band as a classic rock band, which means that they play the same song at the same time. Anyone else?
I'm the national chairman of the League of the Singing Impaired, which is for, I mean, we all know who we are, and the thing to do is to be proud and to go ahead and sing anyway.
I think this fear of singing is a lot like this fear of going off the high dive. That you just have to, you lean over and you can't be thinking about the water and how cold it's going to be and the fact that you're going to drown and all that kind of stuff. There'll be slimy stuff at the bottom. You just have to take that first step and forget about everything else and go with the feeling.
I was a little reluctant, but I'm not the only one. There were some phone calls back and forth between members of the Rock Critics Chorus saying, what have we got ourselves into? I don't know. I don't know. This is really bad. This is really bad. Because we knew, you know, as an ex-rock critic myself, what could happen to us as performers being reviewed by the likes of us.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. On ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang.
Oh my God, ladies and gentlemen, the Rock Bottom Remainders.
I've got a fun meter on me, and my fun meter is riding very high.
It was an opportunity to have fun with other writers and to meet writers that we knew would have the same sense of fun, where we wouldn't be saying to one another, how do you work on characterization in your books? Or, you know, how does plot work for you?
I just had a wonderful time being a remainder at with Amy and Tad. And in spite of all the work, which was way more than I imagined it would be, it was incredible. And I miss everybody, and I want to do it again.
All they have to do is tell me where and when. I'll be there.
Salivating about doing it again. I just don't think that we're too cool to admit how excited we are. Rock Bottom Mania?
Tonight was like a chance to try and do it, because there's a level at which music is something that shouldn't be just something you consume. It should be something that you do and participate in.
You don't have to be a great singer to sing, to be a great entertainer, obviously, but you have to be able to sing.
I loved it from the beginning.
It's really been, in some ways, better than I thought it was going to be. I thought we were going to really stink, and we do, but it doesn't seem to matter so much now.
Remainders never die, and we'll prove it later on.
Ready for Winston Glasses.